Good afternoon. Welcome to CSIS. I'm Andy Cutchins, director of the Russia-Eurasia program here, and delighted that you are all here. Especially delighted to welcome Dr. Marlene Laurel here from Stockholm, Paris, and Boston, and Canada, and many other places in between. Today is indeed a very special day. Today is a special day for another reason, though, and I wanted to note. This is a very important day because it is the birthday of Heidi Hoogerbeets, who works with me, as you know, is the right hand, runs the Russia-Eurasia program here at CSIS. So please join with me in a very spirited version of happy birthday for Heidi. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear Heidi. Happy birthday to you and many more. Okay. You know what's great, Heidi, too, is that you know, you can really celebrate your birthday tonight. You got a big storm tomorrow. Nobody come to work, so you can really go after it. You heard it from me. Okay, let's get to the business at hand. I have been a big fan of Marlene Laurel and her husband, Sebastian Peyrouse, for a number of years, and it's way past time that we actually had the opportunity to meet. So I'm really delighted to have this opportunity today. in particular, in my work in the last year, our work here with Tom Sanderson and Dave and Heidi and others on looking at the Northern Distribution Network in Afghanistan, which took us very in-depth into that part of the world. We were very, very, we very much relied on much of your work and your husband's and even became a bigger fan as a result of that. Marlene is a senior research fellow with the Central Asia and Caucasus Institute and Silk Road Studies Program here at CSIS. And in case you don't know, we are also working together with Fred Starr and CSIS on a phase two of our project looking at how you develop a real regional strategy for Afghanistan that puts greater emphasis on trade, transit, transport issues. And she's based in Stockholm, and her main areas of expertise are nationalism, national identities, political philosophy, and intellectual trends and geopolitical conceptions of Russian and Central Asian elites. Marlene is a remarkably prolific person. If you can just tell from my enumeration of your interests, if you look at her list of publications, it is truly, truly daunting. You know, I thought I had a pretty busy and productive year in 2009, but you just blow me out of the tub. Anyway, some of her recent publications in English are Russian Eurasianism, An Ideology of Empire, published by Woodrow Wilson Press and Johns Hopkins Press. And then in the past year, In the Name of the Nation, Nationalism and Politics in Contemporary Russia by Palgrave. And she also edited a volume that came out last year, Russian Nationalism and the National Reassertion of Russia. And I think what drew us to the topic today in particular is the paper that she wrote for the Jamestown Foundation that came out in August. That was entitled Beyond the Afghan Trauma, Russia's Return to Afghanistan. So, Marlene, we look forward to you clarifying for us what the Russians are really interested in and want to get see happen in Afghanistan. Thanks.
Thank you. So first, I would like to thank Andy for inviting me, and thanks for being here today. This topic of Russian perception of Afghanistan may seem to some of you at least, relatively narrow, because Russia has a lot of other priorities in its foreign policies at Afghanistan, and Moscow is only a small player on the Afghan scene compared, of course, to the West, but also to Pakistan, India, Iran, or China. But first, Russia is part of the Northern Distribution Network, so it's a partner we work with and we need to know better. And second, Russian perception of Afghanistan are a way to discuss the profound contradiction of Russian foreign policy and its ambivalence toward Afghanistan itself and toward, more globally, the international coalition. So as traditionally in Russia, there is a large gap between discourses and realities, between projection of power and real capabilities. And this gap is especially visible on the Afghan issue, which reveals the multiplicity of problems, both domestic and foreign, that Russia has to confront today. So my paper is divided into four parts, and the first one is about precisely this contradictory multiplicity of Russian objectives in Afghanistan. From the start of the international coalition's operation in Afghanistan, Russian leaders have continually criticized NATO political and strategic decisions. They have criticized the refusal of the Afghan government to take into consideration the interests of the country's northern regions. They have criticized NATO's inability to stop poppy production, its inability to treat Afghanistan and Pakistan as an integrated theater of operation until recently, and of course they have criticized military attacks that result in a high number of civilian casualties. So that's true that some part of the Russian ruling circles hope in the failure of the internal coalition that would prevent a U.S. success and a Western long-term presence in this region. But they are in minority, because at the same time, many Russian politicians recognize that a coalition's failure would place Russia in great danger and would have huge domestic implications for Russia. First, because of the drug trafficking, of course. Russia has now more than 4 million drug users, mainly in central Siberia, that is in region close to Central Asia, because drugs arrive relatively cheap. Because of a possible destabilization of Central Asian regimes. And lastly, because of the presence of former Soviet citizens among Islamist groups, mainly Uzbek, Tajik, Chechen, and Dagestani. So the main symbol or personification of this Russian ambivalence is, of course, Dmitry Rogozin himself, Russia's NATO ambassador and a public figure famous for its anti-Western position, but also for his ethno-nationalism and his fear of the Caucasus and Central Asia. Rogozin having himself indicated that a NATO defeat will be a catastrophe for Russia. So the possibility that Moscow will have to manage a still unstable Afghan situation without the help of the international coalition in the next decade feeds the feeling among certain new Russian think tanks that Russia is no more a first-category world player because it cannot and doesn't want to handle a military intervention in Afghanistan. So despite these ambiguities, Moscow is seeking to take advantage of the difficulties that NATO troops are facing. First issue, of course, Russia hopes above all to renegotiate its partnership with the U.S. along lines that it considers more equal. Russia is concerned by the U.S. regular inroads in the Caspian region. Moscow is also concerned by the possibility of a geopolitical turnaround in Central Asia, especially in Uzbekistan. Russia would like to prevent any direct bilateral negotiation from taking place between NATO and the Central Asian state. And in this case, Moscow hasn't succeeded, and the Northern Distribution Network has opened a new page of the history of U.S. Central Asia relations. A second important element of the Russian ambivalence, which is often forgotten, is an economic one. NATO operations in Afghanistan and to a lesser extent in Iraq and Africa saved Russian and Ukrainian civil aviation companies, which rent out cargo and personnel on a large scale to NATO and function mainly thanks to the transit of material bound for NATO troops. So NATO action in Afghanistan is very profitable for Russian economy, especially for the aviation and freight sector. Last point, Moscow opts to develop the role and visibility of both the Collective Security Treaty Organization and the Shanghai Cooperation Organization by presenting them as essential players for any settlement on the Afghan question. This includes the creation of a CSTO Afghanistan working group to coordinate anti-drug measures and a proposal of Russian assistance to the Afghan army. However, Nikolai Bordjujal, the organization general secretary, recognized himself that in practice, cooperation in training Afghan power structures and in the fight against drugs trafficking was very difficult, since Kabul gives preference to bilateral partnerships and not to multilateral ones within the CSTO framework. There is a more or less similar strategy with the SEO. SEO Afghan contact group was institutionalized in 2005. The SEO organized several conferences on the topic of Afghanistan. However, apart from its declarations of intent and its capacity to supervise negotiation with regional players, the SEO by itself as a multilateral organization has little in the way of concrete proposals to offer Kabul. Its financial means are very limited, and the idea of creating collective military or humanitarian forces is difficult to establish and not a desirable objective of the member state. So advances in this domain can probably only happen on a bilateral level, mainly between Moscow and Kabul or between Beijing and Kabul. Moreover, inside the SEO framework, there is no joint economic implementation in Afghanistan. On the contrary, there is a growing competition between Russian and Chinese firms on the Afghan market. So the CSTO and CSO are platform for discussion. They produce a lot of discourses, a lot of critics toward the West, a lot of rhetorics about stabilizing Afghanistan. But they produce relatively few action because they lack multilateral tools to do something, and they don't plan any kind of intervention on the military, on the Afghan territory. My second point is related to the Moscow's growing economic engagement in Afghanistan. Economic relations between Afghanistan and Russia stayed at a very low level in the 90s and the beginning of the 2000s. And the situation really changed only in 2007 after the Club of Paris announced a reduction in of 90% of the Afghan debt, which led to a revival of bilateral exchanges between Moscow and Kabul. So Memorandum for the Development of Trade and Economic Relations was signed, a Russian-Afghan Council for Business uniting more than 60 enterprises were created, and it's now one of the main pro-Afghan lobby in Moscow. More than 1 year ago, in 2008, Russian-Afghan trade underwent a rapid increase, almost three times greater than the previous year figure, totaling $200 million. But $200 million, it's really nothing compared to the $600 million of China-Afghanistan trade or to the $1 billion of Iran and Afghanistan trade. So even if these economic relations are growing relatively quickly, Russia is still a small player on an economic level. Moscow views Afghanistan as a potential market for Russian products, but also as a supplier of raw materials. The Afghan arms market is particularly promising for Moscow. From 2002 to 2005, Russia supplied the Afghan army with technological and military assistance, but this practice has stopped, and now Russia is limited to repairing Afghanistan aviation equipment and to furnishing spare parts without having a place on the official arms markets. But as you can imagine, Rosabaron exports, so the main, the state corporation, Russian state corporation for arm export, is now attempting to secure a place in this Afghan market, and especially to block Bulgarian and Serbian societies which sell Russian technology, and especially, of course, Kalashnikov, without having the license to do so. So Kabul, for its part, is not very interested in Russian products because they are, of course, uncompetitive compared to those coming from Asia, especially from China. But Kabul is interested in Russian investments. Even if Russian businesses are less efficient than their Chinese competitor, they employ local people, while Chinese companies are often accused of importing their own workers. So currently, the largest projects under Russian management in Afghanistan is the renovation of the Naglu hydroelectric station, where about 60 Russian specialists now work. Other Russian firms have won contracts for hydroelectric mini station, for the renovation of Salang Tunnel that links Kabul to the northern provinces. Other Russian firms will supply tanks for oil production to the first Afghan oil and gas terminal based in Karatan. Kamaz, Tupolev are also present on the Afghan territory. The Moscow Industry Bank is planning to open this year a branch in Kabul that would finance Russian-Afghan projects, especially in construction plants, cement factory, agricultural project, and telecommunication industry. In the domain of extraction, Russian companies have not yet succeeded in winning large contracts, and as you know, they have lost the tender to the for the copper mine deposit at Aynak. But main oil and gas fields are concentrated in the country's north and especially close to Mazar-e Sharif. So some of them, which were stopped in the beginning of the 90s, could be restarted, especially because there are still existing structures for gas export to neighboring Uzbekistan. So Russia has some limited but real potentiality based on this Soviet legacy and on the exploitation of the northern part of the country resources. My third point is on Moscow, now in the process of transforming the memory of the Russian-Afghan conflict into an asset. Last year, as you know, Russia marked the 20-year anniversary of its withdrawal from Afghanistan. But now all the humiliation of the 80s, 90s have been partially erased. Ideological conflict related to the Soviet past have attenuated, and nostalgia for Soviet greatness has grown. So it's interesting to see how both Kabul and Moscow now try to put a positive gloss on their on the history of their relations and insist on their historic friendship. The Kremlin is not alone in rewriting history on a very positive side toward Afghanistan, because the Afghan authorities are also playing the end of this reconciliation. But of course, for Afghanistan, we have to replace these pro-Russian discourses in their context, because when Hamid Karzai valorizes Russia, he's in fact sending critical messages to the West and mainly to the U.S. What is sure is that in Afghanistan, Russia openly plays the hand of Soviet past. Priority has been given to the restoring of Soviet economic projects. This continuity has some practical justification, since Russian technicians can more easily restore construction and modernize infrastructures that they are familiar with. But there is also an important symbolic dimension. Moscow does not feel any shame in claiming its Soviet heritage in full view of the Afghan authorities, and the latter do not seem to be humiliated by this. The Russian authorities therefore regularly refer to the year of Soviet-Afghan cooperation preceding the intervention as a model for the type of cooperation Russia is proposing today. Moscow's hypothesis, which is probably correct in terms of popular representation, is that the memory of the years of Soviet-Afghan conflict is partially erased by the three uninterrupted decades of civil war and foreign intervention. So the Soviet intervention no longer represents a unique event and focal point in the Afghan public opinion, but instead counts as one aggression among others. Since the Russian-Afghan conflict is already fairly distant in comparison with contemporary ones, its impact has been relativized. Moreover, Russian can recall that its presence in Afghanistan is not limited to the intervention, but started in the 50s with considerable economic and technical aid to the Afghan monarchy. That's why Moscow regularly discusses in Afghanistan the issue of education and claims that one of its main objectives is the reconstruction of the Afghan education system. And here again, the Soviet past is used as a reference point. Soviet Union built the Kabul Polytechnic University, the Academy of Science, a lot of technical institutes, and negotiations regarding the restoration and reopening of these establishments are now underway. I think the goal for Moscow is to attract specialized Afghan technicians and intellectuals and military people educating during the Soviet period and who are still Russian-speaking. The This Russia's current return to Afghanistan also includes the participation of many former soldiers who served there. The member of a veterans movement, for example, the Fraternity of Combat, which is the main one, have visited Kabul to develop contracts to serve as intermediaries for Russian businessmen looking to set up in Afghanistan or to manage programs for humanitarian assistance. So it's really interesting to see how much those who served in Afghanistan today seems to have become a central element of Russian-Afghan relation and are also well received in Afghanistan itself. We can also notice a kind of ideological activism among Russian think tank about Afghanistan. For example, the MGIMO, the Institute of International Relations, affiliated with the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, has hired people working on Afghanistan. The Institute of Demography, Migration and Regional Development in Moscow has opened an Afghan section, producing a lot of papers proposing a kind of new version of the Greater Central Asia in a, of course, Russian way that will go from Central Siberia to the Persian Gulf. The Academy of Science itself had reopened a center for Afghan studies that was closed a long time ago. So there is really a kind of intellectual activism and multiplication of study centers on Afghanistan that confirms the return of the Afghan question in Russian geopolitical discussion and the likely end of the taboo of Russia-Afghan relation. But of course, the main issue of this element is to articulate these new pro-Afghan lobbies with the ruling circles. And it seems that veterans group, the Afghan-Russian Business Council, and all these new think tank have a relatively small influence on the presidential administration and on the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. But which doesn't mean that they don't play a role in Afghanistan, because I think the Russian... there are really a lot of Russian actors in foreign policy, and the foreign policy is more decentralized than it seems to be. So they play a role, but they are not directly connected to the presidential administration. The fourth point I would like to address here is the issue of Russian capabilities in Afghanistan. I think these Russian capabilities are based on two components. The first one is the relation to Central Asia, and it's a very important element. There is no connection at all between Russian policy in Central Asia and Russian policy in Afghanistan. Not the same people, not the same network, not the same economic involvement. Moscow, for the moment, is still unable to think of Central Asia as partners with their own autonomy and their own will to participate in the reconstruction of Afghanistan. There is no joint economic projects, for example, cooperation between Russian and Central Asian firms in Afghanistan or economic involvement of Russian firms in Central Asia connected to a project in Afghanistan. So Moscow might lose some precious basis if it doesn't not manage to provide some innovative solution to integrate the bordering Central Asian states to its own Afghan strategy. Except, so this cooperation is working with Central Asia, is working only on the military level in the framework of the STO and especially in the framework of the fight against drug trafficking through the Operation Canal, but nothing on an economic level. And I think that's a big mistake for Russia for two reasons. The first one is that China is currently reorganizing its economic implementation in Central Asia to connect it with its strategy in Afghanistan. This is especially the case for Tajikistan, of course, which is conceived of by Beijing as a transit country for its goods to Afghanistan. And Tajik leaders are very happy with that because it increases economic viability of Tajikistan, and they are relatively proud of being associated as a symbolic equal partner. So compared to China, Russia is accused by Central Asia of forgetting Central Asia and of believing that it can act in Afghanistan without a partnership with Central Asia. The second mistake, I think, is that Central Asia is too often forgotten as an economic partner of Afghanistan. Turkmenistan is really involved in Afghan part region of Afghanistan with Turkmen minorities. It provides help in infrastructures, road, electricity. It has established university exchanges, humanitarian assistance to hospital, for example. Tajikistan sells electricity to Afghanistan. The shuttle trade in the autonomous region of Gorno-Badakhshan is really growing and is becoming one of the main driving economic forces for the Tajik economy. Uzbekistan has won the tender of railway to Mazar-e-Sharif and is relatively well engaged in the region of Afghanistan where Uzbeks are very present. And even Kazakhstan has more and more projects in Afghanistan, especially in the construction sector and in the cereal sector. So even if they are very small side projects limited to region of ethnic connection, Central Asia plays an important, pragmatic, and underestimated role in the Afghan reconstruction. Second element of the Russian capability in Afghanistan, it's of course the question of Russia seeking to revitalize the Russophile Afghan lobbies. Two in particular can be identified, politicians of communist sensibility and the Northern Alliance. So in the Afghan establishment today, there is no more taboo on communist period, and elites are relatively proud of their role in the communist government and can be openly pro-Soviet or pro-Russian in Kabul and in Mazar-e-Sharif, but not at all in the south of the country and especially in Kandahar. Northern Afghanistan was, of course, historically always much more closely linked to Russia and Central Asian issues than the Pashtun South. So all Russian network linked to Amjad Massoud and Uzbek General Dostum never stopped working in the 19th and the 2000s, but they are changing now with a new generation. And I think these Afghan lobbies are now more closer to Central Asian government than they are to Russia. But in any case, since 2007, Russia is trying to reactivate its tie with the Northern Alliance by, for example, reopening its consulate in Mazar-e-Sharif. Russia has also a small network among some Pashtun groups situated between Kabul and Kandahar who were part of the communist coalition, and this network could also be reactivated. And since a few months, some observers mention a kind of new Russian activism in the south of Afghanistan. And that's true that last year, for example, during the Russian-Afghan Forum in May 2009, numerous Pashtun businessmen and politicians were invited, some of them being known for being relatively close to the Taliban. And as you can imagine, this was really criticized by the Northern Alliance members, but was defended by the Kremlin with the idea that Russia has to negotiate with all the Afghan actors and not only with the Northern groups. These Russophile lobbies, nevertheless, do not constitute such an easy card for Moscow to play. They are not motivated by a principled solidarity with Moscow, but by stakes internal to Afghanistan and its intergroup balance, which in reality does not give Moscow much leeway. And so Russia has to face the same problem that the international coalition. Afghan elites are no pro-Russian or pro-Western by principle. It's just part of a game internal to Afghanistan and on which internal actors have very few clues and leverage capacities. So it's really difficult to know if Moscow has serious allies in Afghanistan or if being Russophile is only a way for some member of the Afghan elites to bargain support from the West. In a conclusion, I would like to come back on three main, I think, points. The first one is the question that does Russia really produce security? That's one of the main issues for the Western partnership with Moscow. Russia doesn't produce security, for example, in Northern Caucasus. So, of course, the situation is different in Central Asia because Russia is there a more open, more regular partner. But the question is really open. Moscow has no solution to stop, for example, drug traffickings. Moscow has no solution to stop its domestic consumption at home and no way to stop criminalization of Tajikistan and Kyrgyzstan, which are really in the process of becoming narco states. So that's one of the big issues. Second conclusion, there is no one Russian strategy in Afghanistan, but multiple strategies, because there is no clear objective. Russia says it wants stabilization of Afghanistan, but what does really it mean? I mean, it can be peaceful intervention, military intervention, no intervention. So what does it mean related to the international coalition, to the economic involvement of Pakistan, India, Iran, and China, and to possible negotiation with the so-called moderate Taliban? There is no clear Russian statement and proposition on any of these central elements for the Afghan stabilization. Moreover, we are used to think of Russia as an authoritarian, pyramidal, and centralized power, but on some of the foreign policy issue, I'm not sure of the relevance, because if you really look inside the system, the presidential administration has its own objectives and its internal clan wars. I mean, ruling circles have very contradictory point of view toward who is the main threat for Russia now. Is that the West or is that the South? South being Caucasus, Central Asia, Afghanistan, Islam, whatever you want. So really big contradictory conception among the presidential administration itself. The Ministry of Foreign Affairs has another vision of the world than the Defense Ministry of that Rosa Baron export. Moreover, some section of the Russian security services established in Central Asia play very ambiguous game by supplying clandestine groups of fueling underlying conflict between Central Asian state and especially against Uzbekistan. Russian aviation companies transporting goods for NATO troops also transport illegal goods and are doing business in some cities like Kandahar, where they are relatively well integrated. So there are a lot of Russian elements that are not integrated into official strategy of the Russian Ministry of Foreign Affairs. So it's very difficult to know what exactly the game Russia is playing in Afghanistan. And third conclusion, Russia is badly prepared to first the risk of bomb attacks against the northern distribution network on its own territory or in Kazakhstan or in Uzbekistan. And it has to be seen if the CSTO can really act multilaterally in the case something happens. Second, Russia is badly prepared to understand how this northern distribution network could serve as a test test concerning the new relation between Central Asia and the U.S. And third, Russia has no solution to the growing insurgency in the northern part of Afghanistan. And you know that there is a growing presence of some Islamist group, mainly composed by post-Soviet citizens in Kunduz and Baghlan provinces, which try to secure connection with Central Asia. And if this insurgency is confirmed, that is really changing the historical configuration of Russian and Central Asian influence on northern Afghanistan. So to conclude and to let time for discussion, I think Russia is really badly prepared to any kind of asymmetrical war or non-traditional threat linked to Afghanistan and Central Asia. And Russia will continue to be challenged by these contradictory components: internal complexity of the Afghan game, incapacity of thinking of Central Asia as equal partners, ambivalence toward the West. And so Moscow will have to do clearer and more engaged choices in the year to come to prove it's really a stabilizing actor on this Afghan question. And I will stop here to let time for discussion. Thank you very much.
That was a terrific presentation. Really comprehensive. Lots of objectives, no strategy. Gaps between rhetoric, resources, and reality. Yeah, sounds similar to a lot of aspects of Russian foreign policy, I'm afraid. Trying to figure out what the ultimate objectives are is almost impossible. Let's open it up to discussions, questions, comments. Let me turn first to Tom Sanderson. Please identify yourselves for Marlena.
Great. Tom Sanderson, the Transnational Threats Project, and I co-directed with Andy. the NDN study we have here. That was dynamite, Marlene, and very interesting, and a number of things that Andy and I and my colleague Dave Gordon and Heidi have looked at in this study. We're particularly interested, or I'm particularly interested, in the Central Asian element as the player between the United States and Russia. Now, in our study, and I think you're familiar with it, we do look at the role of the NDN as a stimulant for a longer-term strategy of engaging Afghanistan in trade and transport networks across greater Central Asia, across Pan-Eurasia, as a means to bring sustainable sources of income and activity and whatnot. Should the United States recognize this good strategy and coordinate for it and pursue it, it will, by definition, require much greater contact with the Central Asians. You mentioned, of course, as we all know, the Russians are not overly excited about the notion of greater U.S. Central Asian contacts. How do you see Russians reacting to such a development, which we think would be positive for everyone, but nonetheless a steady march forward where Central Asia and the United States cooperate on breaking down barriers to trade across the region?
I think it's always complicated because you have a lot of Russian actors, so it depends on which kind you would like to have a look on. I mean, I think on this trade issue, there are some possibility really to discuss with Russian with Russia, and because if you look at the CAREC, all the CAREC programs for trade and transportation. You have now more and more Russian firms that are interested in developing trade and suppressing, deleting custom barriers. So if this can be articulated with the internal dynamic of the Eurasian economic community, I think Russia could be a player on this game. The issue is that if it's Russia has the feeling that this trade and transportation network will try to avoid Russian territory. Of course, it will be much more complicated, but the main CAREC project now are relatively integrated. I mean, Russian territory is part of the main issue. So I think, and one another element is Kazakhstan has really developed a good relation with some Russian firms, especially through the Eurasian Bank of Development based in Astana, which is really now one of the main thinkers of a kind of transcontinental Eurasian trade. And this bank, I mean, the people working in this bank and publishing a lot of things on the trade and transportation issue have really good connection with some part of the Russian ruling elite. So I think on a pragmatical base, it can really be developed. The question is that if it seems to be ideologized, it will be much more difficult to be discussed. So it needs really to be put as something very pragmatical where every country and all firms can just make money on this issue.
Yeah, thank you. During your presentation, I must say I kept imagining that I was in a comparable seminar in Beijing talking about the Americans in Indochina, because almost everything you said about the Russians in Afghanistan, I think, could be analogized about the United States today in Vietnam, particularly from a Chinese perspective. But what I would like to ask you to do is, let's say we're not in CSIS. Let's say this is a congressional hearing. You're the witness. I'm a member of Congress. What I would say to you is, there's one issue that you haven't addressed at all.
Now you're really in the hot seat.
What does this mean for the United States of America? So what? Forget Russian motives, forget Russian history, forget whether they're smart or not smart, whether it's good or bad for them. My constituents want the United States to fashion some kind of a success in Afghanistan so we can get the hell out of that briar patch. We've been trying to engage all kind of countries, not just our allies, but all kind of countries in that effort. I want to know, is what the Russians are doing or what they're seeking to do a net asset or a net liability to what the United States is trying to do? Are they contributing in any positive way to our ability to fashion whatever it is that we're trying to fashion in Afghanistan, or are they working at contrary purposes to us? Are they basically more or less on our team or not on our team? And as a member of Congress, that's the only thing I want to know.
Thank you.
So difficult question. I think Russia can, I mean, Russian elites and Rogozin and all the other mediatic people can say a lot against NATO, but Russia doesn't really have, to me, the leverage to stop really what is going on now in Afghanistan. So I would say they are more on our team than on the other side. I think they don't have any capacity to really stop what is going on. They don't have the capacity to stop the Northern Distribution Network developing and changing relations between the U.S. and the Central Asian state. They can be unhappy. They can try. They can say they are unhappy with that. They don't have really tools to stop that. I think the situation in Afghanistan is really different to the one in South Caucasus. I mean, South Caucasus was really an issue considered in Russia. They are ready to war for it. I don't think they are ready to oppose the U.S. for Afghanistan because they know they need it. I mean, so it can be a lot of discourses, but in the practice, I think they won't stop anything. They are just an easy partner, but they are still a partner.
I want to know. Are they a useful partner? Is what they are trying to do useful to what we're trying to do with this pitiful excuse for a government that we're dealing with in Kabul?
I think they are useful partner, and in any case, it's impossible to go without them. So, but they are, I mean, and useful and impossible to go without. Well.
They've been extremely helpful on the rail containers coming from Riga through Russia down to Kazakhstan to the border. Been extremely helpful about that. It's very, very important that we have this alternative route. They've also been extremely helpful, as Marlena pointed out, on heavy airlift. And it's interesting that they've been doing this for a long time. And it's been essential for the survival of these companies, Volga, Dnieper, and others. And even, after the Georgia War, when virtually every part of U.S.-Russia cooperation was flushed down the toilet, that was one thing that there wasn't. The Russians continued to do. So when there's money to be made, the Russians are there. But it does seem that their interests are fundamentally mixed in that, when it gets – do they want to see us successful in Afghanistan, or do they want to maintain as much influence in hegemony in Central Asia as possible? Well, they sometimes, I think, want this more than the latter, and I think that came into conflict over Manas, it comes up again and again and again. Let me turn to Michael.
Thank you. Excellent presentation. Yes. You mentioned the SCO, the CSTO. I don't think you mentioned a much larger international organization, namely the OSCE. Earlier this morning at a breakfast, a few of us here heard the deputy foreign minister of Kazakhstan, which, of course, is chairman in office of the OSCE for this entire year, and whose government desperately wants to have a summit meeting to crown their year, and to help people get on the bandwagon they're trying to create, they've kindly given us an agenda that they'd like to pursue, and one of the items on the agenda is Afghanistan. Now, and the OSCE, even if it didn't get in the way of the coalition forces, could probably do some useful work in police training and in border controls and counter-narcotics and things like that. I can't remember whether or not it was during the breakfast or offline later, but I heard them say that the Russians initially opposed including Afghanistan in the OSCE agenda. I guess they probably weren't wild about having 55 other countries get involved in their area. Kazakhstan, of course, likes to sell itself as as a mediator between Asia, Europe, North America, Islamic countries, non-Islamic countries, developed, non-developed, what have you. They're claiming that they actually have been helpful in getting the Russians to change their mind on an OSCE involvement in Afghanistan. My question is, do you know anything about this? Do you think the OSCE could be helpful? What would the Russia, you know, who's thinking what, as far as you can tell, in Moscow about the OSCE being involved in Afghanistan?
I would say that if Russia really opposed having Afghanistan in the program of the OSCE, maybe it's not because of Afghanistan, but because Russia would like Kazakhstan to put on the program a lot of other elements which are important in the discussion between the West, I mean, between European Union, especially, and Russia. I know that Russia supported the Kazakhstani candidate to a presidency chairmanship, especially because Russia would like to have a post-Soviet countries being the chair of the organization in order to discuss especially the migration issue with the European Union and the visa issue. So one of the main goals of Russia thinking about Kazakhstan being the chairmanship is to discuss some very specific relation between Russia and the European Union. So maybe Russia opposed having Afghanistan in the program, not because of Afghanistan, but because there are other priorities for Russia in this Kazakhstani chairmanship. But I think, yeah, Russia would not be in any case interested in having so many countries discussing this issue. I think the more important for Russia is really to be considered as to have bilateral negotiation with the U.S. because it has a kind of symbolic element of being put on the same level as an equal with the U.S. So Russia will always give preferences to kind of bilateral negotiation than to a kind of multilateral framework where there are so many other small and big countries. So the OSCE is not really an interesting platform for Russia discussing Afghanistan. But I think, no, I think Russia has a complex, the Russia relation to the OSCE is very complex because it's also part of the relation to the European Union, and it's relatively conflictual now about the issue of people traveling across the border without visa, and that's really one of the main points that Moscow would like to put on the table during this year, I think so. I think two elements. First, Russia doesn't consider the U.S. as a very important economic actor in Central Asia, in the sense that the U.S. firms are not the most present in the Central Asian market. So I don't think Russia has this kind of question. It has it related to China, because with Chinese firms there is real growing competition, not really with U.S. firms. In the same time, security is also a business. I mean, it's a market, and the Central Asian state have a growing military budget, so there are a lot of money to do in any case for all kind of actor in security businesses. So I think the main point is that all the issue of border controls is relatively open to negotiation with Russia. I have seen how the bomb car project, so funded mainly by the European Union and implemented by UNDP, is very well received in Central Asia, and Russia is relatively open in a negotiation with bomb car organizing, for example, joint border controls and trainings of custom guards. So this is really an element where there is a possibility of negotiation, large negotiation with Russia, because Russia is afraid of the drug trafficking. So the time you begin to speak about border controls, you will have, I mean, someone listen to you in Moscow. On other part of the security issue, so more hard issue, more military issue, like training of military personnel, selling of arms, or I don't know, Caspian fleet, for example, for Kazakhstan. Of course, at this time, the Russian position is less flexible and more blocked with the idea that there is a direct competition with the U.S. So when you speak about some kind of cooperation in non-traditional threats like border control, you really can discuss, I think, with Moscow. When it's more on a hard conception of security, it's more closed.
Thank you, and thanks for a great presentation. My name is David. I work with David Gordon. I work with Tom and Andy on the NDN project. So I have a lot of questions, but I'll limit them to two. And the first is with regards to sort of how Russia views Afghanistan vis-a-vis the situation in the North Caucasus. And I think it's fairly clear that starting in March and really culminating in December, the Obama administration made a clear argument for the connection between our efforts in Afghanistan and U.S. security. Specifically from the terrorist threat. So I'm curious how sort of Russian elites have captured the relationship between the Afghan insurgency in its various parts and the sort of militant threat that they face, both indirectly to their interests in Central Asia and directly in the North Caucasus. And the second question I had, and this was too juicy a tidbit to let go, is you made the point that Russian intelligence services have helped groups which have undermined security. And I'm wondering if you're speaking about the Russian airlift of IMU fighters out of Tajikistan or if it's something more recent than that and ongoing. So I'd just be curious to hear you comment on both those things. Thank you.
On the first point, I think really the Russian conception of security is really based on what is going on in North Caucasus since, now almost two decades. It's really something which is one of the background. I mean, it's a driving force of Russian conception of its own security. I think Russia is especially afraid of losing the Northern Caucasus, which is what is going on now, and is also afraid of all the new kind of not Islamic, but Muslim groups working on the whole Russian territory. That is this idea that the problem is not only limited to a geographical specific part of Russia, which is North Caucasus, but something is developing in all the Muslim part of Russia, and especially in Tatarstan and Bashkortostan. And symbolically for Russia, it's just impossible to have a kind of problem in such part of the Russian territory because it's just so central, so close to Moscow, it would be impossible to have any kind of problem. So there are now some Muslim group, not Islamic in the sense of organizing violence, but more very traditionalized group that try to change the secular tradition among Muslim minorities in Russia. And I think the Russian elites are very well aware of this situation and are really afraid of having in the next decade something completely uncontrollable going on. Another problem is that because of the migration issue, you know that now there are about between 3 and 5 million of Uzbek, Tajik, and Kyrgyz migrants working in Russia. I mean, the border are open. It's easy to go to find a job in Russia, an illegal job, but a job at all. So Russia is really afraid that through this migration network, some Islamist group could try to infiltrate this migrant. It would mean that you will have real security issue, for example, in Moscow directly. I mean, the majority of these migrants, they work in big Russian city and in the capital region. If they are infiltrated by Islamic group, it just becoming uncontrollable for Russia. So I think they try to think everything connected. So the issue is not only Central Asia by itself. It's migrants from Central Asia going inside the Russian territory with this idea that the next step, it's the Russian territory itself, not only North Caucasus, but Russia, Central continental Russia itself. And I think they know they don't have any answers to that. I think they know that what is going on in Northern Caucasus is not going in the good direction and that they are losing. But I think they don't know how to react. I think even some of them are capable of understanding that while they are what they prepare now in Northern Caucasus, it's something like the northern tribal area of Pakistan. It means in 10 years, it will be just impossible to manage the situation. They know that, but they don't know how to change the situation because it's already uncontrollable for them for a lot of economic, illegal, mafia network and other criminalized group. And on your second element, it seems, but it's always, of course, very difficult to have clear information on that, that in 2009, there was special reactivation of some Russian security groups working in Central Asia, trying to put pressure at the Uzbek borders and trying to connect some groups, Islamist group working in South Kyrgyzstan with some other groups based in Tajikistan. So as always, I mean, it's always difficult to have some information, but local experts are really afraid of this kind of strange reactivation of some groups, which I think are not controlled by the Kremlin. I mean, it's just part of groups that are more or less uncontrolled or working alone, doing their own business alone. And they are trying to reactivate some problems in the region linked to the new activism of Islamic groups in especially Tajikistan and south of Kyrgyzstan. So from the people working on Afghanistan, Russian people working on Afghanistan, I mean, really Afghan specialists of Afghanistan, speaking local languages, being advisor there during a Soviet intervention, they have the feeling that the U.S. is doing the same mistakes that they have done during the Soviet intervention. That is mainly having difficulties in understanding level of internal games inside the Afghan society, and it's difficult, of course, to have a leverage on the what is really going on. Recentering on urban area is a bad idea because the Soviet Union did the same, and the main problem is to lose rural areas and not in managing only big centers. And I mean, the main idea, focusing on military issue more on the development issue, which is strange because, I mean, the Soviet Union, before the intervention, was mainly based on kind of development of infrastructure. So that it's another point. So, yeah, the three main critics is too much focus on military issue, too much focus on assuring security in rural urban area and losing rural area, and of course incapacity of understanding the relation between groups inside the Afghan society and how to penetrate them and not to become a hostage of their game by paying, for example, some village people just to stop, I mean, buying security, which they consider either the one of the main problems, and it was already a problem for them when they were there, I mean.
So, bottom line, it's going to fail? Is that their judgment?
You know, that some of the veterans of this Soviet-Afghan war have the feeling that it's very strange. They have the feeling they have lost the war, but in the same time as the Soviet Union, in a way, won the war because all the other powers trying to find a solution for Afghanistan are losing. So the more the West is losing, the more the Soviet Union is winning symbolically, something a posteriori, like a retroactive judgment. But mainly, I mean, these Russian specialists in Afghanistan are relatively pessimistic. Yeah, they think we are losing.
A lot of Schadenfreude. Remember Dmitry Rogozin speaking here in Washington in July of 2008. And I was interested. He went through the usual list of grievances the Russians have with us, but then spoke quite enthusiastically about the potential for cooperation on Afghanistan, although with the very Schadenfreudnistic remark that, you know, remember our guy, Najibullah, he lasted for 3 years. After we left. If you guys leave, your guy, Karzai, wouldn't last 1 week. You may be right. But I wanted to ask a question. You asked the question yourself in your conclusion as to whether the Russians are exporters of security or insecurity. When Tom and I were in Uzbekistan in July, and we were afforded remarkably high-level access, not Karimov, but just about. The answer to that question was an emphatic no. Remarkably emphatic no. And at one point in the discussions with a senior official, he had talked about the Russian interests and their goals and basically their perspective on, as they conveyed to us on the Russian goals, was they prefer to see long-term destabilization because that negates the possibility for opening economic transit corridors for them and others to get products south and elsewhere. And on the security side, it justifies continued, if not expanded, Russian military presence in the region. Well, then he went on to discuss Iran and Iran's interests, which at one point I had to interrupt and say, you know, excuse me, but on the basis of what you just said, I would conclude that you think that on the issue of Afghanistan, stabilization of Afghanistan, that Iran's interests coincide more with Washington's than do Moscow's. And the response was, yeah. Yeah. And I was just wondering about your perspective. Would you agree with that assessment? And how would you parse it out in kind of looking at it in comparative perspective?
I think if you want to find a pragmatic interest in Russia, we need to discuss with people more connecting to economic issue. I mean, and to try to avoid all the more or less ideological part of the establishment. So, of course, I mean, it's not easy to to do, but I think there are some, you can find people, networks, and administration that are ready to discuss on a more pragmatic basis. In Russia, things are very often importantly symbolic. You need to give the impression that Russia is really considered as an equal partner, and then some doors can be open. They can also stay closed, so it's not a guarantee. But, I mean, it's very difficult to put Russia on the same table, but there is no other solution than to find people with which to discuss, so with who to discuss. So, I don't know.
Thanks, Andy. First of all, I should say I'm not in the State Department. I don't know how I got there, but thank you. Thanks anyway. This more just
you haven't heard yet?
It's news to me, and I suspect it's news to the State Department too. Just a comment on this discussion about the question of Russian interests. You described multiple players, multiple objectives, no clear sense of strategy. I think one way of describing it, and certainly what has struck me over the years in talking to Russians and listening to Russian debates about Afghanistan, is really a very deep-seated ambivalence about, in particular, about the American role in the region. And this goes back quite a long ways. It's worth remembering that the Russians started warning us back in the 90s about the Taliban and asking for help. And it got quite, these warnings were quite, got quite regularized by the late 90s. And it's relevant to the way they view the post 9/11 situation. As Andy knows, I was in Moscow then. And after the then Taliban government was overthrown, and it was quite clear that the U.S. was going to be present for some indeterminate period of time, there were many discussions in the political class about what this meant. Was this good or bad for Russia? And I remember one exchange which, in a sense, dramatized the broader reaction. One argument was being made was saying, look, we had been warning the West about this for years. They didn't act. They've finally now gotten rid of this government. They have just dealt with a security problem that we can't handle. And there was a guy, retired general sitting in the room, and you could see sort of the steam coming out of his ears. And he listened to this, and he pointed his head and said, "Here I understand it." Then he pointed to his stomach and said, "Here I hate it." And that view, here I understand it and here I hate it, I think is something that has characterized a lot of these discussions since then. There was a joke also that I heard, which had a serious point to it, about the American presence. And the joke at the time in Moscow was there are two outcomes they really worry about. One is that we'll stay, and the other is that we'll leave. And I think that's still there. They don't like relying on us. They don't like the idea that we're going to have a more central role. But they don't see. I agree with you. I don't think they feel they can handle the consequences on their own. And so the issue is therefore not whether they like it or not. Is what's the nature of the engagement and what's their role? And I think they're very uncertain about both.
Yes, Shojito, visiting fellow here at GSIS. Well, I'd like you to elaborate more on the implication of the worsening distrust between China and Russia for the United States. Well, ironically, when China's projection of influence over Central Asia was much less vivid than today, Russia has some idea to appreciate U.S. presence as a counterbalancing factor vis-a-vis China, at least until soon after 9/11. Then U.S.-Russia relations were worsened drastically, and then now we are sitting here. Now, as you clearly mentioned, Russia must face more projected Chinese influence over the territory. So what kind of discourse have you come across in terms of the, let's say, usability or any kind of possibility of accepting U.S. presence as a Russian strategy vis-a-vis China today?
We have the same kind of permanent ambivalences. I mean, on the short-term perspective, China-Russia alliance is, of course, very useful for Moscow and for Beijing because it's allowed discourses about against American unilateralism. In a long-term perspective, of course, China is becoming a real problem for Russian strategic thinking. But on all the official discourses, documents of national security, national strategy, and so on in Russian, there is nothing against China. I mean, China is always presented as an ally, and the West continues to be presented as the main enemy. Or the main problematic element, NATO expansion, and so on. But when you really try to discuss with Russian experts, you can find a completely other view. And I think it's really changing now in Russia, the perception of this both danger, the West and China. And I think there is a new generation of Russian experts who is now more open to the West and who become really afraid about China in a long-term perspective. And I think more and more Russian experts now are really afraid of what would be Russia at the end of the 21st century if China continued to be, or really become a superpower. So the relation on this, both U.S.-China presence in Central Asia is always very ambiguous, depending of if you ask people a question about contemporary issue or about projecting themselves in half a century. If you ask them now, they would say they, of course, are happy about the SCO cooperation with China and they hope U.S. bases will stop. But if you ask them, are they okay to open for China to open military bases, you will have a fully negative answers from Russia and from Central Asia. states also. I mean, that's another important point to mention. Central Asian states are not at all interested in a possible Chinese base on their territory. If you ask them to project themselves in half a century, you will have a completely other discourse that China will be a danger and the West will be more or less an ally or an easy partnership. I think that's really how the issue is now formulated in Russia, is that the West is not an enemy, but it's not a partner, a full partner. It's something uneasy, and it will stay uneasy for at least still a relatively long time. And the position on China is really changing and becoming more and more negative on a long-term perspective. And even inside some officially Sinophile groups like the militaro-industrial complex in Russia, which is really also in changing its perspective on China now.
Tom, I think we have time for one more.
Just three quick comments on a few things we've discussed. Number one, following the discussion Andy and I had with these senior Uzbek officials, I went to Almaty a few weeks later, and in discussing that particular position with Nazarbayev's think tank, there was a split. I said, do you agree with the Uzbek position? And half of them said, no way, the Russians are interested in stabilization. The other half said, no, we agree with the Uzbeks. And there was quite a heated discussion between them. I suddenly became a completely irrelevant topic. And I was the one there to question them, and they had a debate. So that was certainly an issue.
You closed them down. Huh?
Yeah. On China, a couple of interesting things. Back to Tashkent, Andy and I were talking with one of the cabinet members, and they said, listen, they gave us, for those of you who are familiar with the Goldilocks and Three Bears story, they said, listen, Russia is here for nefarious reasons. They're too hot. The U.S. is too cold. You're here just for the military and an overnight relationship. But China is long-term and quiet, and that's what we like. When I was in Tajikistan in October, a few of the people said, yeah, we love the Chinese presence, but you know what? We're getting really worried because they bring so much, so many gifts to us that we feel we're going to lose control of ours. So this is the Tajik perspective mm-hmm. on the long-term concern, concern threat of China. So it's really interesting to see the mix of views. But I think your overall point of which Russia and which topic are we talking about is a great takeaway. For most people in here, it's that's been known. But I think that's great to reinforce is which Russia are we talking about, which topic, and in which time, which time frame exactly. are we talking about.
Yeah. Well, Marlena, thanks so much. You really, it was a terrific presentation. I think you really cut right to the core of some of the key ambivalences in Russian thinking. Just reminded yesterday, a few of us were briefing Secretary Albright, who is leading a NATO strategy group that's going to be in Moscow next week, and someone had come forth with some polling data that showed that more than 50% of Russians viewed NATO as a threat to Russian interests, and more than 50% of Russians believed that Russia should try to cooperate with NATO. And Isn't this a contradiction? In my view, well, actually, no. At one level, of course, it is a contradiction, but not real. My explanation was this, in that because I've seen similar polling data also on China, and I think it's simply at the one level there's an idea of what Russia's interests are and what we'd like that world to be, and you know certainly it's in that world NATO is a interests are not coincident with ours. But they're pragmatic enough to realize that this is not going to go away, and you need to work with it. And the same with China. Well, I want to thank you again. I forgot to mention at the outset that Washington will soon be very fortunate to have both Marlena and Sebastian in residence sometime. We don't know exactly when. In 2010, they'll be based here, so we look forward to seeing a lot more of you. And thank you very much for your thoughts today.